Ann Ahlquist, Director of Radio here. Congress clawed back over $1 billion already appropriated for public radio and television this year and next. That means as of October 1st, Prairie Public loses about $2.5 million in federal and state support. Thanks to everyone who supported and advocated for us. And if you'd like to make a contribution, click on the donate button at prairiepublic.org.
We've made it to a Thursday here on Main Street on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we have a packed show today. In the second half of today's show, it's Bluegrass Goes Pink. We'll preview the story that's behind the Bluegrass Goes Pink concert. It's a day-long celebration, and that's this Saturday at Cross Ranch State Park. Also, Dave Thompson stops by the Main Street studio. He and I will review the news, and of course it's Thursday. That means Madeline will stop by the Main Street studio for another of his great movie reviews. This one is more local. It's AJ Goes to the Dog Park, and this indie comedy was shot in Fargo Moorhead, and it's gaining national attention. We begin Main Street today with Dr. Brad Strand. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Health, Nutrition, and Exercise Sciences at North Dakota State University. For decades, Dr. Strand has researched youth sports, highlighting the profound influence they have on physical health, emotional well-being, and personal growth. Dr. Strand, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
I'm going to ask you to answer this question with one answer, and then we're going to go on from there. In North Dakota, do we get youth sports right?
We are probably getting it more right than we find in a lot of states.
That's good news, but there's a lot to discuss. Your research and other studies that you have done emphasize that youth sports has become adult-driven, competitive, and commercialized. We've talked a little bit about this before. How did we get here, and why is this problematic for kids?
Yeah, those are very good questions. How did we get here? You know, you think back to 30 years ago, and kids just played sports in the backyards, on the front yards, in the courts, in the streets, with their friends. And over time, parents became more engaged. Some of it had to do with making sure the kids were safe. You know, we got this, we were led to believe that it's not safe to let your kids go outside and play by themselves because somebody's gonna steal them, somebody's gonna, you know, whatever, take them. And so we started watching over them more closely. I don't know if that's a bad thing or not. We want our kids to be safe. And so so instead of telling your kids to get on your bike and ride to baseball practice, let's just say.
Which I did as a kid.
Exactly. We're going to take them to baseball practice. And we want them to be safe, so we're going to sit there and watch them at baseball practice. And so this begins that slippery slope of parents being engaged and involved. And then we start seeing the advent of youth sport camps. And you go back 30 years ago, 40 years ago, those youth sport camps were just pretty much getting started. And high school coaches were running them, college coaches were running them. It's a way to make a, it's a side hustle in the summertime. And to be honest with you, perhaps most kids didn't gain a whole lot from them. You go to a, let's say a basketball camp, you spend 3 days doing some drills, meeting some kids, having some fun, playing some games, getting some ribbons, and you go home and then you do whatever you do in the summertime. So to be real, you know, not much came from them really in terms of skill development. But over time, these camps became more and more popular, and instead of one camp, you'd have to go to two or three camps because you want to get noticed, because these camps are now a gateway to getting a college scholarship. So if you don't go to the camps, how are coaches going to notice you? So this is, like we said before, a big sucking sound where you kind of get sucked into this that you have to go in order to be noticed, in order to try to get a scholarship. So I think that's kind of the advent of how this stuff kind of mushroomed from being just kids playing sports to the engagement, the commercialization of youth sports.
One of the things that you've talked a lot about, you've researched about, is that kids more today are more likely to specialize. And they're likely to specialize at a very young age. And by specialization, we mean they're going to be a baseball player and they're going to play baseball, which you can do year-round in Fargo because there are indoor facilities that allow you to do that. And that's what they're going to be, thinks the mom and dad, when the kid's eight.
Exactly. So we have most high school coaches would tell athletes to be multi-sport athletes. And most research would show that most professional athletes have been multi-sport athletes and not specialized.
Why don't we hear that?
That's a good question. Why don't we hear that? And part of the answer is coaches say, I want you to be a multi-sport athlete, but on the same breath, if you're a basketball player, they're telling you that you have to go to basketball camps in the summertime.
This is our family.
And you have to.
I can't play baseball, Dad, because we've got camps and tournaments in June, in July, into August. And when do I have time for baseball?
Yes. So there's a dichotomy there where coaches know it and they tell their athletes to be multi-sport athletes, but really specialize in mind. You know what I mean?
Is it because there's pressure on their coaches to do the job?
To win. It's all about winning in many situations.
In North Dakota high schools, it's about winning, you're saying.
It gets to be about winning. And that's driven more from parents and coaches, perhaps, than it is from the athletes. We might have mentioned this before, but Fargo Public Schools used to survey, I don't know if they still do that, but survey all the high school kids playing activities. And they would ask them, the kid would select from a series of answers, why do you participate in extracurricular activities? And for most kids, like in sports, winning was way down the list. That's not what they were chasing. It was to be with friends, to learn new skills, to get to travel, lots of things, but not winning. So for the kids, that's not the driver.
So it's participating, it's community, it's being with friends.
Most of them, yes. That's what they want out of the experience. And you know, when we start talking about the scholarships, really only about 2% of high school kids end up getting a college scholarship.
2%.
2% get a college scholarship. And of that, really only 1% of high school kids might get a full ride scholarship, which means tuition and books and all those kind of things.
So one in 100 kids who are going down the road we just talked about are going to land that full ride scholarship.
Yes, so not very many. And of those kids that get a college scholarship, perhaps 1, maybe 2% will ever have a chance to play professional sports. So again, not very many.
So now we're in the range of 1 in 1,000.
Exactly, of high school kids. Exactly. It's 0.08% of high school kids that might play professional sports. The average professional sporting career is about 3 years. So do the math. The odds are stacked against you. However, dollar in a dream, you know? Somebody's gonna make it.
Someone will.
Someone will.
One is a big word there.
So really, when you think about how much parents invest in their kids' sporting activities.
Those who can afford it.
Those who can afford it, yep. And that could be $1,000 in the summertime to attend different camps and buy the equipment and the uniforms and everything that goes along with it. By the end of, let's say, 10 years of youth sports getting till you get out of high school, you spend a lot of money. And if some of that was parlayed into a fund for education, maybe you can get...
That scholarship would have been there.
Exactly right.
In the bank.
Exactly.
Ready to go.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about math that you have talked about in your career. You say that roughly 70% of kids drop out of organized sports, not in high school, but by age 13.
Yes.
Okay, so we know that coaches think kids should play a lot of sports. Administrators, I would guess, talk about the value of youth sports all the time.
Yep.
They must know this too, that 70% of kids are dropping out of organized sports. We have those stories in our family of a coach who did this or a parent who did that, and it's just crazy, the cost. What's driving the dropout rate then, Dr. Stratton? What are we getting wrong there?
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a number of things that could probably drive the dropout rate. For some of it is the kids have tried a sport, it didn't fit. And they try another sport, and it didn't fit. And maybe you've tried 6 different sports, and it didn't fit. And maybe the 7th one fits. And so I had a son that tried 4 or 5 different sports, and it just wasn't his thing. He kept dropping out of every one. He gave it a shot, but it wasn't for him. So sometimes we just drop out because it's not our thing. And we have other things that we're doing. So maybe it's not that they're not doing anything. It's just that they're not doing sports. Maybe they're into music. Maybe they're into arts. Maybe they're into drawing, painting. Maybe that's their gift, so to speak.
Still into extracurricular activities.
Something with
maybe.
Extracurricular, yes.
Which is good.
Which is still a positive thing. But it is concerning that when you have 70% dropping out of youth sports. You go, what's causing kids to drop out of youth sports? Again, some might not like it, but that's not the full reason why they're dropping out. Some of it gets to be the pressure put on them by their parents and by themselves and by the coaches. The expectations that you have to, and what we're talking about, get a scholarship. This is going to be the thing that's going to get you, us as a family, money in the future, right? And that pressure builds and builds and builds. And by the time you're 15, it's like, I can't do this anymore. And maybe you were an early developer, and the late bloomers now are caught up to you. And you got to suck it up and watch someone who was struggling now surpass you. That's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of kids. And so rather than slug through it, you just find a reason to say, I'm done.
So the fun has disappeared.
Oh, well, that's probably the biggest driver right there.
And we know from your research,
yeah,
from common sense really, that sports should be fun.
Yes.
So why haven't we figured that out in retention? Why haven't administrators figured it out that we need to have sports programs, including maybe varsity sports, but good solid sports programs or communities that we invest in, that we make a priority so that kids can have fun, because we know that's important.
Yeah, so a big thing to identify is, what does fun mean? And I think when we say that, so kids go into sports, number one reason to go in is to have fun. Number one reason they drop out is it's not fun. Okay, so how do kids define fun? And sometimes when we throw that term out there, it's like we're supposed to be laughing and giggling and doing that, and that's not really what it means. Having fun means being with your compadres. Having fun means learning new skills. Having fun means having some victories. Having fun means relationships. That's all part of having fun. And the not having fun then comes from the lack of a relationship, the belittling of a person because of their ineptitude, let's just say, the hazing that comes with, you know, if you're not the guy sometimes.
Bullying and hazing,
yeah. And so then it's not fun anymore. Why would you want to go to practice if those things are happening to you, right? So fun doesn't have to be that we're just going to hit and giggle and not take it seriously. We still take it seriously, and we still strive to do the best we can. If winning is the end result, great, but we're just trying to, I would hope that we're just working on the progress of getting better, and then winning will happen at some point.
But it makes me wonder, coaches oftentimes are thrown into the place of being a coach without much planning, without much support, without much instruction, without the ability to even know that, okay, I'm supposed to win, right? Or no, wait, I'm supposed to have fun here and we can work on the other stuff. We don't support the administrators and coaches in youth sports very well, I perceive.
I agree 100%. We're lucky to have parents that are willing to step up and be the coach. Because if we don't, we don't have these programs for kids. Conversely, many of the parents are honestly not trained to be coaches. They might have played sports.
And there's training that can be helpful.
Without 100%. We have the North Dakota High School Coaches Conference coming up next week in Fargo. So all across the coaches, high school coaches from all across the state are gathering in Fargo, and they're doing 4 days of training to become better at what they do. And the basketball coaches will have a session they can go to every hour of the day, eight sessions a day, six, maybe six, for four straight days, and learn to be a better basketball coach. Same with golf, wrestling. So the high school coaches are continually getting this continuing education to get better at what they do.
Some might argue they're also getting paid for it.
Well, they get paid to be coaches.
Right.
They don't get paid to come to the conference.
That's
on their dime.
But the parent who has decided to create his traveling youth basketball team and now figures out who he perceives the good kids to be and only is with those kids, maybe hasn't had any training at all.
That's exactly right. And it becomes very selective. And they deselect certain kids that they deem not good enough.
At a young age.
You know, there's talent identification, there's talent development, there's talent selection, and you think, which of those comes first? And to me, it would be talent development. That's what we should focus on first.
We gotta win,
so we do talent selection based on what a six-year-old can do right now. Like, and some six-year-olds probably have 3 years of experience because their mom and dad we're with them and others don't have no experience. And so we're assuming this kid is better than that kid. Well, momentarily he has more skills because he's been doing it for a while longer. But in time, the other one might catch up, but we've deselected that person and they may never get a chance after that. So we're missing a whole group of kids, missing giving them an opportunity to develop their sports skills.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Dr. Brad Strand. He's been on Main Street before and we're glad that he's with us today. Professor Emeritus now. Congratulations on your retirement, by the way, Dr. Strand.
Thank you.
From the Department of Health, Nutrition, and Exercise Sciences at North Dakota State University. For decades, he's researched youth sports. There's kids who can afford it, and there are certainly kids and families who cannot. What's our community's responsibility there?
Yeah. Again, we look back years ago, and the Park District used to run the summertime youth sport leagues, and every kid could participate. It wasn't about the income level of anybody, it's just for all. And then we started getting more specific youth sport leagues, like Little League Baseball, FM Athletics in Fargo, and then we started getting the travel teams, and obviously they take money to operate, to go to tournaments, and obviously certain kids are excluded because of that. And I, to be honest with you, I don't know the real answer. How do you help those kids who come from a lower socioeconomic level have the opportunity to get onto a travel team? I suppose you provide some kind of a scholarship that, that maybe somebody else has paid for them to be a part of the team. Maybe you overlook their having to pay to be a part of the team, and maybe somebody else then absorbs that cost.
I hate to ask it this way, but would it be the case that some parents don't want to pay that kid because all of a sudden, guess what, he might be better than my kid?
100%. 100%.
Hey, keep phrasing it that way.
Yes. We take care of our own first.
Yep.
You know, and so, yeah, that's a good point. So I wish there was a good answer for how do we allow and how do we fund opportunities for all children to have an equal opportunity to be on some of these. They call them elite teams, but to be honest, they're not elite, really, when you talk about elite.
I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
Do you want to drill down on that a little bit? Because not in parents' eyes, right?
No.
They are elite.
We call elite, but the term, like you're on the elite 9-year-old baseball team.
It's almost laughable to me when we say that, yet that's the way the structure is.
Exactly right. You know, they can't throw the ball more than 30 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour as a pitcher, and yet it's elite level. Well, I don't know.
So we want to talk about something you've written about, positive youth development. We've talked about communities and we've talked about schools and we've talked about kids who can't afford it and kids who can't. This seems different than a traditional model, yet the reason I reached out to you this time was a New York Times story recently that said, look, Charlie, youth traveling sports isn't going away. In fact, it is a multi-billion dollar industry that's growing and growing and growing. And again, I ask you, you've written about and advocated for positive youth development.
Yeah.
Are we too late?
I think we're too late. I think we're too late in a lot of ways. You know, this the article you're referring to said that youth sports has become a $40 billion industry. It's more than the NFL. It's a bigger industry than the NFL. It's projected to become a $70 billion industry within about 3 or 4 years. The article you're referring to mentions two gentlemen who have started buying up youth league facilities in towns and conglomerating them. And one of these is a guy that owns the Washington Commanders, I believe, or Philadelphia Phillies, I forget which. But these two guys are buying up properties in towns that are youth league properties or youth league facilities and making them even bigger youth league things. So the intent is to have mega events. You know, the Olympics is a mega event, and developing countries want to host the Olympics because hosting the Olympics is huge. The Super Bowl is a mega event. The World Cup, mega event. Cities fight for hosting those events.
And so, spend.
Yes. And so now we've done the same thing with youth league sports. If we can build a community that hosts a mega event in youth league sports, and I'll take the hockey tournament in Fargo where the kids come from all over the United States to play in this big hockey tournament in the United States. Huge economic driver for the community. And so in one sense, you'd argue that it's really good for Fargo-Moorhead. Visitors Bureau would say it's great. People like myself say, but at what expense for the kids? You know, you're missing school, and you say, yeah, but they're getting a great experience meeting kids from other states. And I'd say, yeah, but they're 6 years old. Do they really need that experience? And so we can go back and forth on the value of that, and we can make good points both ways. But the fact that cities are investing millions of dollars to build youth sport facilities, it just seems a little bit out of whack.
We're having this conversation in, what is it, South Fargo or maybe West Fargo South, and a couple miles from here, it's one of those facilities.
Exactly.
The brand new Fargo Sports.
Yes. It's a beautiful place, and it's designed to host some of these big events. I think they had an 80-team basketball tournament early last year when they first opened it up. A lot of money involved there. You know,
full disclosure, my granddaughter participated in that tournament.
Yeah, so there's good things that come from some of this, but I think the biggest concern that what we're talking about is that by moving in this direction, by having these so-called select teams, these travel teams, and it takes a lot of money to have one of these teams to go play in a mega event, and only certain kids have the opportunity to participate. That's the big concern that we have. That's one of the big concerns that we have. The advent of a lot of this, though, is also driven kids away from sports because it's a full-time job. It's every weekend. Now, granted, some kids love that. You get to go play more games.
Let me drill that down a little bit. Do the kids love it, or do the parents love it enough so that their kids love it?
That's a good question. Parents, it's funny, parents complain / brag about their
calendar.
Their calendar. Exactly. And we have this, and we have that, and we have this game, and it's not...
Oh, woe is me, but isn't it great?
Yeah, exactly. And so somebody's telling that they have this schedule, and their friend just ups them a little bit because we got a specialized practice with a specialized coach, and it's a one-upsmanship. And so the more you're doing, it seems like the more accolades you deserve as a parent for what you're doing for your kids. And I don't mean to insult any parents. It's not that at all. We're all doing what we think is best for our kids. The kids want to be engaged, and they tell mom and dad, you know, I want to do this. And all the neighborhood kids are doing it, and the family friends are doing it. And so we use the word entrapped. And so a lot of parents get entrapped into one more thing and one more thing. And some parent has their daughter doing a special one-on-one training with a coach. And so then you got to do the special one-on-one training with the coach. And it just starts to escalate. And I guess the key is, how do we de-escalate some of this back to a better sense of normalcy? But today's society is people want this, apparently.
I mean, I hate to ask this, and I think I've asked before in this interview, we're too late. Are there answers? Are there recommendations? Are there things that school administrators should do? Are there things that city council people should do? Are there things that maybe churches should do to help here?
One of the things that I read in terms of youth coaches, youth sport coaches, and we talked a little bit about them not being as well prepared as maybe they could be or should be. The California has a 25x25 program they just started. And for the year 2025, they wanted to educate 25,000 youth sport coaches on best practices in youth sports. I thought, what a great model. Now, in North Dakota, how do we do that? Well, we don't have to educate 25,000 youth sport coaches, but let's make it, it's all relative. And if we could educate 250 youth sport coaches with best practices and appropriate practices and the emotional well-being of children and how to best teach sports psych skills, how to best teach technical, tactical skills, that'd be a great step forward in helping youth sport coaches. So you'd like to think that there's enough sporting organizations in Fargo-Moorhead. There's the High School Coaches Association in North Dakota. And if we can get, how about Sanford Health? They care about kids' well-being. And get some of these entities together and package something so that we could provide training for coaches. But what's in it for the coaches? I mean, a lot of times it's just one and done.
My kid ages out, I'm out of here. We're doing something else or
yes.
Whatever.
Yep.
Or I just got done from work 6 minutes ago and now I'm here.
Yes.
All right, let's go.
Yep.
It's a commitment.
It's a commitment, and there's only so much time in the day, and I'm just not going to commit. And if you're going to require that I go to, let's just say, 4 hours of training, I'm going to say, I'm not doing it. And now we don't have a coach. So this is a dilemma that we get in.
It's something worth working for, though.
It is. It really is, yes.
That was Dr. Brad Strand, professor emeritus from North Dakota State University and youth sports expert. He and I will continue our conversation about youth sports, including what all of this means for girls who are participating in youth sports. That will follow this coming Monday. Still to come on Main Street, Bluegrass Goes Pink. It's the 13th annual Bluegrass Concert at Cross Ranch State Park. We'll preview the event. Dave Thompson will stop by. We'll review the news. And Matt O'Lean reviews AJ Goes to the Dog Park, an indie comedy shot right here in Fargo-Moorhead that's gaining national attention. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and it's not every day that you find a foot-stomping bluegrass show, a glow-in-the-dark hike, a homemade church supper, and a 10K run all rolled into one powerful day of purpose. But that's exactly what's happening at Cross Ranch State Park this coming Saturday, July 26th. It's another edition, Jill Weiss, of Bluegrass Goes Pink. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to bring this edition back to all you folks, that's for sure.
There's going to be music. There's going to be meaning. Let's roll back, Jill. Why is this event so important? It creates awareness about cancer and also the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation. Tell us the relationship.
Yeah, so the history real quickly is my sister Barb Wild passed away when she was 50 of breast cancer. She fought that for 11 years, diagnosed at 39. So we rode that train with her, and she was all about awareness and education and causes and everything. And so I felt at the 10-year mark, I said to the band, we need to do an event for the Cancer Center, because I work there part-time as a nurse. And I know what we do for our patients with the foundation. So we just said, well, let's just do a one-night concert over at the park, which is kind of our backyard because we do the Bluegrass Festival there too. So we asked the park, and of course they were on board, and the Cancer Center had a lot of volunteers to help, and we just had a one-night concert and just had a great number of people there. And they said, well, we'll see you next year. And so we're at year 13.
Congratulations
about that. And the first year we remembered Barb. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate that. So every year we remembered Barb and just my family. We had some pink cotton t-shirts with kind of her name on it. And then the next year we thought, well, let's remember somebody else. And so then we moved forward with, oh, somebody else passed away of cancer. And then we had their names on the shirts with a symbol kind of next to their name. So then that worked out really kind of nice. People would reach out to us and say, hey, my dad died. We're going to come up and camp. Can we remember our dad or mom or brother or somebody? And that has been a real meaningful part of the event. But to tell you, we kick off pretty early Saturday morning, 8 o'clock registration. And honestly, there's a lot of people that like to get up early and run in the morning. I'm not one, but we get a good group out there. I wouldn't do it, but we will for this. And we get a nice group of folks out in the morning. I mean, anywhere from tutus to kids in a wagon and dogs on a leash and babies in strollers, kids riding bikes. We get a core good group out there. That's $20. You get a shirt or a tank top. And then even the dogs get their own special water bowl, just saying it. And then at 5:30, all the Washburn churches and my Washburn ambulance will be serving a great meal for a free will offering. And then the concert is $10 with Cottonwood. And we're just so excited to be able to put this on again. And the weather's going to be great, too.
Jill, tell me, this is personal to you, obviously. Is it hard for you to perform when you're really thinking about your sister?
You know, so we do a candle lighting about 45 minutes into the concert. And that's where we have the five families come up and light a candle. And so, for example, this year it's Kathy Van Middlesworth, Deborah Donahue, David Sandrich, Shannon Krause, and Lana Fry. And so those families come up, and I see, you know, kind of the sadness in their eyes, and but they're glad to honor their loved one, and they light a little candle, and I light Barb's candle, and we take a picture, and we all hug. And then some of them will speak. We'll have a microphone and they might say a few words. And then we get back on stage and we sing this very sad song that Jimmy Fortune wrote about heaven. And it's called I Believe. And actually, Jimmy Fortune let us record that song and change the words. So the second verse, he had said, I was there the day my mama went to heaven. Well, I sing it, I was there the day my sister went to heaven. And I was with her that night she died. Mm. And so this year it falls on the day she died, July 26th, 23 years ago now. And so that, if I can get through the beginning of that verse, I can't really look at anybody in the crowd, because then a lot of people know about Barb. And so then if I can get through that, and I think even a funeral singer will tell you, do not look at the family. Mm-hmm. When they're singing at a funeral, do not look at the family, because then you're done, you know? And so anyway, yeah, I think of her, but I think of how much fun she'd have had at this event. She loved the Cross Ranch. She loved the Missouri River. And so she would have been just a spitfire of this event. So it's up to us to kind of take the torch. You know, and you kind of want to be strong, but yeah, a lot of musicians cry at a certain song. But my daughter will be right next to me. She sings and plays too. So if I go, she'll pick it up. She'll take the reins, you know? But it's special to honor these people that we do every year. I want to make it about them. And they really, really, they all come up, they all have their shirts and tanks on, you know, and I'm so happy we can help have them help a fun evening too, you know.
You encourage everyone to wear pink if they can, but it's not a requirement. And there's really, Jill, there's no pre-registration really for anything either. Is that right?
No.
Yeah.
No. And you know, we encourage people to bring cash. We do have one of those little machines on your phone, you know, the square. The Wi-Fi is sometimes good and sometimes not. And so we encourage people to write a check or bring cash. That's probably the best. If they don't, that's fine too. We'll work it out. But yeah, it's a great, great time. And we remember all these patients over the years and friends and family. And it's really, really an honorable time. But it's fun to get all the Washburn churches out there too, and the ambulance. It's fun for them to be out there as well. And it's just a great setting. And then there is a glow hike after the concert, as it starts to kind of get dark there. The park staff has everybody meet over at the visitor center, and they have some glow sticks and they take everybody on a little hike. So that's kind of fun too.
Well, let's retell our listeners here the chain of events. It's 8:00 this coming Saturday. It's Bluegrass Goes Pink. It's at the Cross Ranch State Park. This is an event that's held in partnership and in benefit of the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation. At 8 a.m., 5K and 10K walkers or runners begin. Registration for that is $20. Then at 5:30 p.m., a free will donation supper will be provided by Jill and her great friends at the Washburn Area Churches. At 7:00, Cottonwood and Friends, that's when their bluegrass concert begins. It's $10 for that concert, or just $5 if you participated in the walk or run. And those under 16 are free. And of course, all proceeds go to the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation. 10:00, there is a hike, a glow hike, I guess is the best way you might describe that, Jill. We wish you the best, and I'm sure you're inviting everyone to come.
Yes, and to clarify, registration will be at 8 a.m. at the Visitor Center at the park, and the walk run begins at 9.
There we go.
So come on out. If you can't make the night, come on out for the morning and enjoy a good walk or run on those beautiful trails.
Our guest has been Jill Wiest. She's one of the event organizers and a member of the beloved Cottonwood Bluegrass Band. The event is Bluegrass Goes Pink. It's this Saturday, July 26th at Cross Ranch State Park. Jill, thank you for this work, and it's always great to visit with you.
Yep, take care, Craig. Good talking to you.
We all know what that great tune means. It means it's time to review the news with Prairie Public's news director, the veteran. Dave, I'm thinking of more adjectives here, but I'll just leave it at that for now. Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
We don't have a lot of time today, but Dave, what's the biggest story you think that we had this week in North Dakota?
Well, there are a couple, and one is going to surprise you. Number one, you know, this idea that we've got in works now a presidential disaster declaration for the hail and the tornadoes and the high winds, some counties in North Dakota. Now, apparently, there's enough damage to trigger more governmental-type damage, but not enough to trigger individual assistance programs, which is okay because a state program has been opened up for that. So if somebody lost their grain bin, you could go to the Bank of North Dakota and borrow some money there. Well, the other story that you might find surprising is that the Bismarck Airport is going to expand to the tune of $160 million.
Wow,
going to add two jetways. They're going to add lots of square footage because there is a growing demand. And that's the bigger story that we've been following, is the growing demand for air travel in North Dakota.
No question, air services up in the state. Dave, what are you working on for next week?
This is going to be a little surprise because I don't know if you and I ever talked about this, but there is actually a state DOGE program. It isn't like the federal. This one's being run by the legislature. But they're going to have their first committee meeting next week.
Dave, it was quick, but it's always great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
I hope you do, Craig. Thanks so much.
Has rolled his way, I guess, into the Main Street studio. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
We get to review a film each and every week with you, Matt, and it's something I really look forward to. This film is maybe a little bit different in many ways, but it's certainly local. The film is AJ Goes to the Dog Park. What do you have to say about this film?
Well, I saw this at the Fargo Film Festival in March, and a couple weeks ago they had their world premiere with the distribution deal they have gotten, and that was at the Fargo Theater, and they're on a current tour of the U.S. Showing this movie. So I'm not going to do a full-fledged review because I know too many people in the movie. The producer, Ben Hansen, the director, Toby Jones, our friend Greg Carlson, who comes on this show from time to time, Concordia College film professor, is in the movie in a hilarious part that he has. Tucker Lucas, who I know, was the videographer on the film. So what I'm going to talk about basically is kind of where people can see this movie. If they didn't see it at the Fargo Theater, it is on like a tour right now, and I'll kind of tell where that's going. But the interesting thing here is that they got a distribution deal, and it's basically through Doppelganger Releasing, which is associated with Music Box Films. So I would say in the current day, Craig, it's a little easier to get a distribution deal than it used to be. Because, you know, it used to be, you know, you had to be one of the big studios or, you know, you release it through independent films, that kind of thing. And it's tricky. I've often said making a good narrative feature movie is one of the hardest things to do in the world. It's amazing anything ever comes off because so many things can go wrong. This is a lower budget film shot in Fargo-Moorhead by friends. But it is amusing. I would say it's kind of inside the beltway amusing, kind of this humor between that group of friends that I just mentioned to you. Some people may not get it, some will. I'll briefly go over the plot. In humdrum Fargo, an ordinary man named AJ, played by AJ Thompson, wakes up on the right side of the bed every day, content with his mundane existence. His simple routine consists of buttering cinnamon toast for breakfast, eating dinner with his married best friends, and visiting the dog park with his beloved chihuahuas. However, his interruption of his tranquility happens soon, including a promotion at work, which he turns down from his dad, who's his boss. Unfortunately, the despotic local mayor has converted his dog park into a blog park, where happy dog walkers have been replaced with corporate stooges hunched over laptops, and hilarity ensues from there. It is funny in parts, and, you know, it's a low-budget film, and I give them all the credit in the world for not just making it and being satisfied to screen it at the Fargo Film Festival. Ben Hansen, the producer, who I know, I had him in class years ago at Moorhead State, really worked hard, he and Toby Jones, to get a distribution deal, and they got it. And I will say, if you have missed this movie, Ben tells me there will be a video on demand release soon. The Blu-ray will be out in October or November through a company called Cartoona, and it should be streaming by early 2026. So Doppelganger Releasing is one of these companies that tries to release films that aren't, you know, don't have George Clooney in them or some huge stars. So right now, after Fargo, the film premiered in Sioux Falls, then it went to Woodbury, Minnesota. They just got done with an Ohio run in Columbus and Cincinnati, and they're in Ann Arbor right now, and they'll be at the Music Box Theater in Chicago. And from there, it goes to Iowa City, New York, Los Angeles, Boulder, Colorado, Austin, and Charlotte. So Ben and Toby have done a great job getting this film out there. My understanding is they're getting pretty good crowds at these theaters. I will say the humor is very Fargo-Moorhead-centric. So what I want to ask Ben when he gets back is, how did the film play with audiences outside of Fargo? That's a question I can't answer on this show because I've not been following them around the country on this tour. But I am wondering if the humor translates to Cincinnati or Columbus or Charlotte from the Fargo-Moorhead community. Not sure about that. That'll be interesting to see where it goes from here. But again, this is what persistence can do if people are persistent in the movie industry, because there's nothing more difficult than getting a distribution deal for a documentary, a narrative feature. It's almost impossible to get, Craig, for a short film. Short films are typically only seen at film festivals. So the film business is a hard business, especially in America, where there isn't really these overarching, you know, Canadian Film Board or the UK Film Board, where people can get money from the government to go make movies. That really does not happen very much in the U.S. The U.S. film industry is the purest form of capitalism that I can think of, one of the most pure forms of capitalism. You're on your own. You go into the film industry, there are no guarantees careers are going to work out at all. I've had a lot of kids in class when I've adjuncted film studies that want to be the next Steven Spielberg. And you know what? There probably isn't going to be another Steven Spielberg. So
sure,
if you can just work in the industry like some of these people that I've mentioned do, you can have a career. But it's important that they got this distribution deal, and I want to congratulate them. And if you have a chance to see it, it is an amusing, shorter film. And I think people, especially in the Fargo-Moorhead region, will find it amusing.
I have not seen the film. But as I understand it, and as you alluded to, Fargo plays a central mm-hmm. role in the story, almost like a character. It sounds to me, from what I've read about the film, is the city portrayed well? How does the community of Fargo come off in this film?
I think it comes off fine. I mean, people will be excited to see the locations. That's one of the things I think is interesting when people watch movies that are made in the Fargo-Moorhead area or Grand Forks or wherever. They can spot the locations, and people kind of get excited about that because, you know, this doesn't happen in major films, you know, except the movie Fargo, which was not shot in and around Fargo, as you know. It's not a hotbed for filmmaking. There is no North Dakota Film Commission in the state. That's a long time, I think, issue that Margie Bailey and I have had with the state of North Dakota, is they really don't support movie making. And a lot of films could have been shot in North Dakota, like The Revenant or Fargo, had there been some sort of financial interest for a filmmaker to shoot here. So when there isn't a financial interest, they go to states that will make it easier for them to film. So Fargo-Moorhead comes off great. Greg Carlson's house is used in the movie, and I've been to his house many times. So, I mean, it's kind of a love letter to Fargo-Moorhead and kind of quirky people that kind of get into their normal routines of life.
Matt, this movie comes almost a decade after AJ's Infinite Summer.
Yes.
Is there a relationship
there? Yes. So the same group of people made that short film, which is a very entertaining short film that I've seen. Now it's been expanded into a feature. A lot of people weren't paid to be in this movie. They just did it out of the love of kind of helping out their friends. And I will say the performances are pretty good. You know, the woman who plays the mayor is funny. She kind of plays this evil mayor of Fargo who wants to ruin AJ's dog park. There's a gigantic demon that shows up later in the film who tries to destroy Fargo-Moorhead. So there's a battle that ensues there. Someone dressed in the demon outfit was at the Q&A at the Fargo Theater a couple weeks ago, so that made that all fun and exciting. So I urge people to try to see this, and they'll enjoy the locations and hopefully some of the inside the Beltway humor. What I'm familiar with, because I know these people, but some people might be a little baffled by the humor if they don't know Ben and Greg and Toby and Tucker, but, you know, I'm happy for them.
All right, Matt, what's coming down the line for our listeners to anticipate for our movie reviews?
Director Ari Aster has a new film out called Eddington with Pedro Pascal, who seems to be in every movie right now this year. Pedro Pascal is in a lot of movies. And curiously enough, the other film I'm going to see soon is Fantastic Four, starring Pedro Pascal.
All right.
So
sure.
He's the man of the moment right now. Reviews are very mixed on Eddington. I told you a few weeks ago I wasn't sure how Superman and Fantastic Four would hit at the box office. Superman has hit big at the box office. Yeah. So that I think, outperformed my expectations for that movie, and they cast it very well with David Corenswet and Rachel Brosnahan and Nicholas Holt as Lex Luthor. I still see Gene Hackman in that part, but Bradley Cooper's cameo as Jor-El is interesting as well. A lot of good casting in that movie, especially Nathan Fillion as the Green Lantern. So if you haven't seen Superman, I think it's worth checking out, and I'm not a comic book guy by nature. But we'll see if Fantastic Four hits with Marvel or not. That's the one I'm a little less sure of. I thought Superman would hit pretty well. Not sure about Fantastic Four. We will see.
All right, Matt, we'll almost silently now advance to the trivia part of our review. What Oscar-winning film holds the record for the fewest spoken words by its lead actor, who still took home the Academy Award for Best Actor?
That is The Artist from 2011, and Best Actor went to Jean Dujardin, and I think his only words were, "with pleasure," at the end of the
movie. At the very end,
yes.
Two words.
Two words. Best actor. With pleasure, he says.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 24th. On 6th Street in Wahpeton is an apartment complex known as the Hoover House. Obscured by box-like additions is the original house, built by banker and business tycoon J.W. Hayward around 1882. It was once one of the finest residences in town. Hayward came from Ohio with two other young men seeking their fortunes in Dakota Territory. After a business failure and legal troubles in 1886, he returned to Ohio. The house was later acquired by W.D. Henry, another wealthy banker and entrepreneur. Mr. Henry was the only living uncle of First Lady Mrs. Herbert H. Hoover. The Henrys were frequent visitors to the White House, and the Hoover family occasionally visited the Henry House in Wahpeton. Mr. and Mrs. Henry took a keen interest in the Native American students and staff at the Wahpeton Indian School. They made charitable contributions, including tuition for students to attend the local college. When a student died suddenly from dental sepsis, they provided a funeral and burial. Mrs. Henry also established a Campfire Girls chapter at the school. A student named Marie Paul became a ward of Mr. and Mrs. Henry, living with them in the Hoover House. After Mrs. Henry's death, Marie remained in the household. She was sometimes identified as Mr. Henry's driver. In 1929, Mrs. Herbert Hoover and Mr. Henry toured New York City. Mr. Henry had attended the president's inauguration the previous month, along with Marie Paul, who was identified as his adopted daughter by Wahpeton newspapers. On this date in 1931, local papers reported an attempted extortion from Mr. Henry as unsolved. Miss Paul had driven Mr. Henry to the drop-off site near Fairmont, followed by deputy sheriffs. Authorities found no sign of a suspect. The ominous note Henry received was believed to be a prank, since only $75 was demanded. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can catch Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org. And why don't you subscribe to Main Street as a podcast? It's wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Coming tomorrow, Friday at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question, how do we fix the national debt? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Monday, we'll look forward to our conversation with historians Molly Rosum and David Vail, who are digging deep into the NDSU archives. With landmark books already behind them and new ones in progress, their work promises fresh insights into the cultural and agricultural history of the Great Plains. Until then, Have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again right here on Main Street.